Israel is getting ready for war outside of Gaza as tensions rise with Iran.
We are in challenging times. We are in the midst of the war in Gaza, which continues in full force. At the same time, we continue our unceasing efforts to return our hostages. But we are also preparing for scenarios of challenges in other arenas.
Leaders of the U.S., Japan, and the Philippines gather at the White House.
The United States' defense commitments to Japan and to the Philippines are ironclad.
And it's the stuff of science fiction. Micro-robots fighting cancer.
The microbot is the first of its kind.
Today is Friday, April 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. While the war in Gaza is Israel's focus, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Thursday that Israel was also preparing for scenarios in other areas. We get details now from Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan.
His comments come amid concern Iran is preparing to strike Israel in response for the killing of senior Iranian commanders in Damascus on April 1st. Israel has not claimed the killings, but Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said on Wednesday Israel must be punished, and it shall be for the attack.
Please have a seat.
U.S. President Joe Biden said on Wednesday Iran was threatening to launch a significant attack in Israel, while Germany and Russia have both called on countries in the Middle East to show restraint. Tehran has avoided direct confrontation with Israel or the United States, with Iran-backed groups declaring support for the Palestinians, waging attacks from Lebanon, Yemen and Iraq. Here's Netanyahu visiting troops at Tel Nof Air Force Base in southern Israel on Thursday.
I said we are in challenging times. We are in the midst of the war in Gaza, which continues in full force. At the same time, we continue our unceasing efforts to return our hostages. But we are also preparing for scenarios of challenges in other arenas. And we established a simple principle. Whoever hurts us, we hurt him. We are preparing to meet the security need of the State of Israel, both in defence and in attack. I and the people of Israel trust you, and may we all have great success.
Most Israeli troops have pulled out of Gaza in preparation for an assault on the southern city of Rafah, where more than 1 million Palestinians are sheltering.
Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh on Thursday denied his sons were Hamas fighters. The sons and their sons, his grandchildren, were killed in an Israeli strike this week, saying the interests of the Palestinian people are placed ahead of everything. He said again that the deaths would not affect the ceasefire talks. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock called for calm and diplomatic restraint as tensions rise in the Middle East. She said these days all diplomatic telephone lines are running hot to prevent regional escalation. Israel is constructing a new land crossing into Gaza designed mainly to facilitate deliveries of humanitarian aid from overseas or neighboring Jordan. Here's Israeli military spokesman Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari.
Well, Hamas continues to hold 133 hostages and use Gazans as human shields. Israel continues to facilitate the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza and find new ways to increase this effort. We are constructing the northern crossing, a new land crossing from Israel into northern Gaza, to enable more aid to flow directly to civilians in the areas that have been challenging for the trucks to access.
So, has the conflict reached an inflection point? VOA's Lori London put the question to Elliot Abrams, senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington.
I'm not sure it's at an inflection point in the sense that the Israelis have from the beginning said the goal is to eliminate Hamas as a military force that can threaten Israel and as the government of Gaza. That requires moving eventually against the Hamas battalions and leadership in Rafah. And I don't think that that goal on the part of Israel has changed. Nor, I hope, will the United States attempt to prevent that from happening. If those Hamas brigades survive and the leadership survives, then in a sense, Hamas will have won the war. And that is a terrible thing for the United States and for all of our friends in the region. It's a huge victory for radicalism, for extremism, for terrorist groups in league with Iran. On the humanitarian side, more is being done, and there will be still more. I gather, for example, the United States is building a pier that will be able to accept ships coming from Cyprus. There's more coming from Jordan. The Israelis have opened up a new route into northern Gaza, and that's just beginning. And I hope and assume that in the coming days, even not just weeks, days, we'll see more food and medicine, among other things, going into Gaza. There is a stronger effort to prevent the Israelis from winning this war. I think it would be disastrous for the United States, all of our friends in the region, including Israel, if that happens.
What's the end game? What constitutes victory for Israel?
What constitutes victory for Israel is having Hamas in a situation where it cannot govern any part of Gaza, and it cannot constitute a military threat to Israel. If those four brigades, others will tell you there are six brigades in southern Gaza, in Rafah, survive essentially intact with the leadership intact, then Hamas poses a threat to regenerate as a military threat and as the government of Gaza, and that should not be permitted.
Benjamin Netanyahu said that he's also preparing for scenarios in other areas amid obvious concerns that Iran is preparing to strike Israel in response to the killing of senior Iranian commanders. And then we've got tensions between Israel and Lebanon's Hezbollah continuing, as do the attacks by Yemen-based Houthis in the Red Sea. Overall, it would appear the Middle East is in a pretty dire state at the moment.
This is all about Iran. This is all Iran. What gave Hamas the wherewithal to do its attack in October? Iran. What gives the Houthis the ability to attack shipping? Iran. What has built Hezbollah into a fierce military force? Iran. None of this is self-generated. It's all Iran.
Elliot Abrams with the Council on Foreign Relations, talking to VOA's Laurie London. We're following these other stories from around the world. A Vietnamese real estate tycoon has been sentenced to death in the country's biggest ever financial fraud case. Death sentences are not uncommon in Vietnam, but it is rare in financial crime cases, and for someone this well-known. Tru My Lan is a high-profile businesswoman who chaired a sprawling company that developed luxury apartments and hotels and offices and shopping malls. The European Central Bank has opened the door for an interest rate cut as early as June. The bank left rates unchanged on Thursday but said there are signs that inflation is finally heading toward its goal of 2%. China's top legislator, Chao Laji, arrived in North Korea on Thursday and held talks with his counterpart, Choi Young Hae, on promoting exchange and cooperation between the two countries in all areas. North Korea's KCNA news agency reported all of this on Friday. Drone attacks on the Russian-held Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine are a consequential juncture in the war in Ukraine and must stop. That's what UN nuclear watchdog chief Rafael Grossi told his agency's 35-nation board of governors on Thursday.
On Sunday, direct attacks against the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant marked a major escalation of the nuclear safety and security dangers in Ukraine, significantly increasing the risk of a nuclear accident.
It is Europe's largest nuclear power station located near the Ukraine war's front line. It requires constant power to cool the reactors and prevent a potentially catastrophic meltdown.
No one can conceivably benefit or gain any military or political advantage from attacks against nuclear facilities. Attacking a nuclear power plant, ladies and gentlemen, is an absolute no-go.
Russian missiles and drones destroyed a large electricity plant near Kyiv on Thursday, ramping up pressure on the energy system as Ukraine runs low on air defenses. Kyiv's appeals for urgent air defense supplies from the West have grown increasingly desperate since Russia renewed its long-range aerial assaults on the Ukrainian energy system last month. Poland is in talks with Ukraine about supplying it with Soviet-era air defense missiles. Meanwhile, in the U.S. House of Representatives, word that the talks to get U.S. funding for Ukraine are moving forward and could actually happen. Here are the details on this from Associated Press correspondent Norman Hall.
House Speaker Mike Johnson is negotiating with the White House as he prepares to advance wartime funding for Ukraine and Israel despite Republican division. House Republican leader Steve Scalise told reporters that Johnson had been talking with White House officials about a package that would deviate from the Senate's $95 billion foreign security package and include several Republican demands. Johnson has delayed for months advancing aid that would provide desperately needed ammunition and weaponry for Kyiv. Norman Hall, Washington.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Long simmering tensions between China and its neighbors took center stage on Thursday as leaders of the United States, Japan, and the Philippines gathered at the White House to push back on Beijing's stepped up pressure on Manila in the disputed South China Sea.
And I want to be clear, the United States defense commitments to Japan and to the Philippines are ironclad. As I've said before, any attack on Philippine aircraft, vessels, or armed forces in the South China Sea would invoke our mutual defense treaty.
U.S. President Joe Biden. Japanese leader Fumio Kishida was both at the White House meeting and also addressed a joint session of the U.S. Congress. He said Ukraine risks collapsing under Russia's onslaught without U.S. support, a disaster that could embolden China and spark a new crisis in East Asia.
Today, I detect an undercurrent of self-doubt among some Americans about what your role in the world should be. This self-doubt is arising at the time when our world is at history's turning point.
He also said,
the world needs the United States to continue playing this pivotal role in the affairs of nations.
Kishida and Biden on Wednesday unveiled plans for military cooperation and projects ranging from missiles to moon landings, strengthening their alliance with an eye on countering both China and Russia. Opposition candidates are accusing Chad's military ruler, General Mahamat Idriss Deby, of flouting election rules and launching his campaign before the official starting date on April 14th. He seized power after the death of his father in 2021 and is attempting to cement the rule with a victory in Chad's presidential election next month. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from neighboring Cameroon.
Several hundred people, a majority from Chad's Patriotic Salvation Movement or MPS party, applaud as transitional president General Mahamat Idriss Deby says more than 200 opposition political parties and about 1,000 civil society groups have agreed to support him in the May 6 presidential election. Deby is the nominee of MPS for the presidential poll. The general said on state TV Wednesday that if elected as Chad's president, he will continue to maintain peace and develop the Central African state. Deby says he is very happy that civilians agree he has good intentions to make Chad a country with a peaceful environment where people's rights and freedoms are respected. But Chad's opposition accuses Deby of illegally launching his campaign early. Lizzie Basenda is a presidential candidate of the Party for Democracy and Full Independence of Chad. She is the only female candidate in the race. Basenda says nine opposition challengers have informed Chad's National Agency for the Management of Elections, ANGE, or ANGE, that Deby has launched campaigning for the first round of the presidential election before April 14, when campaigning is supposed to be launched officially as the Central African State's Constitutional Council planned. Basenda said Chad's 8 million registered voters should not be intimidated by Deby, who wants to continue the rule of his father, Idris Deby Itno, who ruled Chad for more than 30 years. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And in our continuing coverage of the U.S. presidential election, we look at reproductive rights, which are again at the forefront of the U.S. presidential campaign. As Republican candidate Donald Trump distances himself from an Arizona Supreme Court decision to ban most abortions in the state. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns has our story.
This was a week when Donald Trump sought to lay out a position on restricting abortion that stops short of a nationwide ban backed by some prominent members of his party.
The states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state.
The next day, Arizona's top court set an 1864 state law that bans nearly all abortions, even in cases of rape or incest, can still be enforced. Trump said that state decision goes too far.
You know, it's all about states' rights, and we straighten that. And I'm sure that the governor and everybody else are going to bring it back into reason, and that will be taken care of, I think, very quickly.
Arizona's Governor Democrat Katie Hobbs moved quickly to block county attorneys from prosecuting women and doctors who provide abortions.
I refuse to allow extremist county prosecutors to use this abortion ban to lock up women and doctors seeking or providing needed health care. Second, my administration has expanded access to over-the-counter contraceptives.
In Florida, the state Supreme Court has allowed a law banning abortions beyond 6 weeks of pregnancy to take effect next month. Trump's trying to reassure voters that states will change those unpopular decisions, while reminding them that he's the one who ended federal abortion protections.
We did that. It was an incredible thing, an incredible achievement. We did that, and now the states have it, and the states are putting out what they want. It's the will of the people. So Florida's probably going to change. Arizona's going to definitely change. Everybody wants that to happen. And you're getting the will of the people. It's been pretty amazing.
A statement from President Joe Biden's campaign says Donald Trump owns the suffering and chaos happening right now, including in Arizona, because he proudly overturned federal protections for abortion. Arizona is an important swing state in this presidential election, where supporters of abortion rights said last week that they have enough signatures to include on the November ballot a measure that would put abortion rights in the state constitution. Arizona Congressman Greg Stanton, a Democrat, believes his state and the nation are at a turning point on abortion.
This November, in Arizona, safe and legal abortion access will be on the ballot. And people won't walk. They will run to the polls in Arizona. And they'll come out in force to elect candidates who truly, consistently, and sincerely support abortion rights at every level of government, especially here in Congress.
Similar ballot initiatives in Kansas and Ohio over the past 2 years were losing propositions for Republicans. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
And finally, It's like a science fiction movie. The first of its kind micro-robot that can navigate in a cell network and stimulate individual cells in a targeted manner. The discovery has potential for new treatment methods for patients battling cancer or other diseases. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino says they are tiny green cells.
Researchers at the Technical University of Munich, or TUM, say the microbot is the first of its kind and has the potential to offer new treatment methods for patients battling cancer or other diseases. Berna Erskine-Edelman is the lead researcher at TUM.
We're using these microrobots to build tissues under synthetic conditions. And the whole point of this is to, in the future, then repair damaged tissue or organs at a really patient basis. So if I can sort of like, you know, manufacturing cars in a robotic factory.
The tiny robots are made from seaweed, and the team has found a way to produce millions of them in just minutes. They are about half the width of a human hair, or about the same size as human cells. They are soft like human cells, too, and can be controlled wirelessly. Philip Harder is a PhD student working on the project.
We have gold nanoparticles inside the robots, and with a laser, we can heat certain areas of the robot. Then when we point the laser in the direction of the robot, we can see that it starts to move. And so we can then move it within the cell clusters and move it to other locations and then look at several cells in different ways.
Erskine Edelman said the micro-robots aren't ready to help cancer patients just yet, but that the technology is supporting research already underway.
The more we find out about these cells, the more, the better we can actually design therapeutics.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has announced a preliminary agreement with the giant Taiwan chip company TSMC to build a third semiconductor factory in Arizona. Semiconductors, those tiny chips smaller than the tip of your finger, power everything from smartphones to cars to satellites and weapon systems, said President Joe Biden in a statement. America invented these chips, but over time we went from producing nearly 40% of the world's capacity to close to 10%, and none of the most advanced chips, exposing us to significant economic and national security vulnerabilities. I was determined to turn that around, and thanks to my CHIPS and Science Act, a key part of my Investing in America agenda, semiconductor manufacturing and jobs are making a comeback. The COVID-19 crisis exposed alarming vulnerabilities in the U.S. chip supply chain, which domestic semiconductor manufacturing will ameliorate. Another key issue surrounding semiconductors was recently discussed at the EU-U.S. Trade and Technology Council meeting in April in Leuven, Belgium. Export controls aimed at protecting technologies that have clear national security implications. Over the past 2 years, the U.S. has imposed such controls, which restrict companies from selling chips and other advanced computing equipment that could have military applications. The People's Republic of China has objected to such export controls and has tried to frustrate and evade them. At a press briefing after the Trade and Technology Council meeting in Leuven, U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo spoke of the need for vigilance and constant dialogue with partners to counter the actions of the PRC.
The Chinese wake up every day trying to figure out how to do an end run around our export controls so that they and potentially their military can access our most sophisticated technology, including chips, which means we have to wake up every day just as motivated to protect the citizens of our country. And we do that in collaboration with our partners, in this case, the Europeans. There's no end game. It is a constant work.
At the same briefing, Secretary of State Antony Blinken noted over the past 3 years, there has been increasing alignment between the U.S. and the European Union on the issues related to advanced technology. And he said, when the United States and the European Union are aligned, when we're working in common purpose, it's a very powerful force.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.